Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the editors and writers at StrategyPage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of StrategyPage.com. We'll be talking to Jim Dunnigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of StrategyPage.com, and Austin Bay, author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net. Jim and Austin are working on the fourth edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War that will be published shortly. Today we're going to be talking about the current situation in Georgia and some of the ramifications of the Russian incursion. Austin, do you think we're headed towards another Cold War?
Here's why, because I see the Cold War as being a definite bipolar division. It was one that was predominantly, certainly from the early 50s or mid-50s on a thermonuclear brink. Russia has lost so much with the end of Russia lost the Cold War. Now, as Jim's very clever quip, we're watching the empire struggle back, which is, of course, the title of our Russia chapter in the fourth edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War, which will be out within the next couple of months. Russia itself is trying to struggle back to regain. Assert control in some of its, now this is one of those push words out there, but on its periphery in some of its areas of traditional control. Part of what's going on is that Russia sees itself as having stabilized again, stabilized in part because of the oil wealth, and at the we're talking about ethnic component, these isolated or remnant Russian communities have a domestic political import within Russia. It's one that can't be dismissed. It's one that, of course, politicians can invoke or provoke, but the Russian concern for ethnic Russian communities, no longer in Russian control, is a real domestic issue inside Russia, and that's why you see with these, it's like Moldova and the Transdniestrian Republic, Transdniester being a predominantly Russian ethnic separatist zone from Moldova. So the situation, to get back to your question, the situation that existed after World War II that morphed into the Cold War, which was more or less frozen by mutually assured destruction, nuclear weapons, that doesn't exist now. Could you have Russia acting as a rogue nation with a veto? Well, we've seen, actually saw the Soviet Union do that at times during the Cold War. Russia today has many, many interests, investments in Western Europe. We talk about the situation that Russia can influence Germany and France and Central Europe by natural gas imports and petroleum imports. That's true. But at the same time, they're Russia's buyers. You can alienate your consumers, and there are alternatives out there. This is a different kind of balancing mechanism, and it's a change from the military balance of power to one where it gets a little bit more obscure, but it involves diplomacy and involves economics. That doesn't mean that Russia won't pick up the sword. They've demonstrated in Georgia that they will.
Yeah, it's a much more complicated world now in that there is no true bipolar group, that we've got a lot of different actors getting involved, and that we've got all these different tensions also involved. So I don't think we're going to go back to...
Well, Dan, look, the West has rolled east. That's one of the Russian causes of wounded Russian pride. Ukraine, yeah, substantial Russian ethnic communities in eastern Ukraine. Notice that, remember during the Ukraine Orange Revolution, you saw a lot of maps pop up about where Ukrainians lived and what were predominantly Russian areas. But Ukraine wants to join the EU. Ukraine would like to join NATO. Poland is NATO now. And interestingly enough, yes, part of Russia remains on Poland's border. And that's that Kaliningrad Oblast, which is the old Kaliningrad area that was a remnant of East Prussia at one time, that the that the Russians have retained. Is that a forward base for Moscow, or is it an isolated Russian island? It would certainly be. It could be both simultaneously. The geostrategic situation has changed so dramatically from the Cold War, and geographically, political boundaries, economic orientations, that to call this a new Cold War, I think it's a cheap headline is what it amounts to. It is much more intricate. It's much more involved, and this does not in any shape, form, or fashion mean to say that the new oligarchy, which is what I have called it in a recent On Point essay that's on the strategy page, the new oligarchy, maybe it's behaving a little bit more like a czar. I called his group a czarist with a czarist policy. That'd be something I'd like to hear Jim's comment on. But it is not in the same context of the Cold War.
Well, it's mostly domestic politics. You can be very popular as a politician in Russia, and Putin and his crew are very popular. Not so much because they're conquering neighbors, but because they've restored the economy. They pay the pensions on time, and they index them with inflation. They've kept inflation down. There are more jobs. Infrastructure is being... Crime is down. And they're playing to Russian pride. Because the Russians, remember, they went through 70 years of communist propaganda about the evil West, about, you know, Russia's mission to, you know, communize the world and bring the revolution to everybody. And even though most Russians believe the revolution was a bunch of crap and hooey and a big scam, they still like the idea of Russia being a major player. And Russia, for all the progress it's made in the last decade with getting its economy, economic affairs in order, and what have you, is no longer a major player. Now, the British took the loss of empire very graciously. But as most Europeans will tell you, the Russians are not gracious like the British. And they're basically expressing their dislike for the current situation in the same boorish manner that Russians have always been, you know, expected to express themselves. I mean, the attitudes of the European have towards Russian hasn't changed in centuries, especially since the 18th century. And the Russian attitudes towards the rest of the world hasn't changed for centuries because they're always afraid of getting invaded. They have no natural, you know, boundaries, to, you know, obstacles to keep invaders out. And this goes very deep into the Russian psyche. Everybody's against this. I mean, these people are, this is a country where paranoia is a popular indoor sport through those long winters. And
you've been overrun by Mongols. You might be that way too.
Exactly. Right. I said, you know, just being paranoid doesn't mean they're not really trying to get us. And they are indeed afraid, not so much of the Mongols, but of the Chinese. Because the Chinese basically threatened to grab all of Siberia, and what the hell is Russia going to do to stop them other than, you know, start a nuclear war. So the Russians have a lot to be afraid about. But they also have a lot to constantly you know, think about. And what they think about is the loss of respect, the loss of power, the loss of security. And so anybody who plays upon, you know, bad-mouthing NATO, bad-mouthing the West, bad-mouthing anybody who's doing anything on our borders is going to be one very popular politician. And what does a politician want to be, even in a not-so-perfect democracy? Popular. So they're playing to the voters. And unfortunately, you know, this doesn't get interpreted that way in the West. But people should understand. And you can see this. I mean, people in the internet age, you can go to the English language versions of Russian, you know, media, and you can read it for yourself.
Right.
Although it sounds much better in the native Russian. But they don't do it. They don't do a bad job of translating, you know, their paranoia and, you know, nationalism into English. And it's all for there. Anybody who wants to see it, there it is. So don't depend on CNN or NBC, you know, or the New York Times, heaven forbid, for your, you know, insight into Russia. You can go get it from the Russians themselves.
Now, one of the things that you've written about, Jim, is the deterioration of the military forces inside of Russia. Now, I looked at some of the videos as the Russian troops rolled across the border into Georgia. They did, to me, they didn't look well disciplined. It looked like a sort of a ragtag bunch coming through
Well, it depends on who they got on camera. Now, the media is going to go look for pictures of the people who make the most dramatic picture. So they basically went looking for pictures of the irregulars. The Russian troops that were sent into Ossetia were mainly the kontrakty, the professional troops. The Russian military has two classes of soldiers now. Conscripts were only there for a year or so, and so obviously they never become very impressive looking. And then what they call the contract troops, you get paid about four or five times as much as the conscripts and are expected to basically perform at a much higher level. But over half the troops that the Russians brought into Georgia were either Ossetian or Chechen, you know, irregulars, you know, paramilitaries and what have you. And you know how these guys disport themselves. They don't march. They scowl and, you know, shake their weapons at you. And that obviously makes great theater, and the media laps it up.
Right. I saw a lot of broken, on one of the videos that I think we posted on the site, we saw a lot of broken down trucks and stuff on the site.
Yeah, because they haven't gotten any new, the Russian army hasn't really gotten much new equipment in the last 20 years. They're talking, if you look at what the press release, as it were, when they talk about we're going to do this, we're going to revise it, it's always we're gonna. What we've done is much less. They are starting to buy some stuff, but a lot of their equipment is basically late 1980s vintage. And that stuff eventually wears out, and you were seeing it as they were rolling into Georgia, but that was probably one of the longest road marches some of those units have taken, you know, in a long time. Because they basically took the units in the station in Chechnya, where they still have a garrison of about 50, 60,000 military and paramilitary troops. But those guys have been sitting there for over a decade. And they, in turn, were basically reserve units stationed further up in the Caucasus in southern Russia. And so you have trucks that have moved, you know, maybe a couple of hundred kilometers in 30 years, you know, in two sweeps. And in the meantime, they haven't gotten the greatest maintenance in the world. But that's the state of the Russian army. They do have a core of troops. They have 100, 200,000 troops are professionals, well-trained, know what the heck they're doing, but they're basically getting by on Cold War surplus equipment and weapons.
Yeah.
Well, the one point that I'd make out of this, they did good enough for what they've done. Admittedly, the Georgian army's, 37,000 troops, Jim, is that right? And,
closer to 30, yeah, with reserves.
Yeah, and good figure for peacekeeping, but for all of the lurching and some of the, you know, reports that we had on how well, at least in some of the initial engagements, some of the forward Georgian forces did, the Russians did, on the ground, good enough. And remember, they've got nuclear weapons as well. So
right.
That's...
Yeah, well, they had air superiority, and they had numbers initially, plus they had surprise. The Georgians didn't expect them to do that, which is shame on the Georgians for not planning for that contingency. As time goes by and more details come out, it looks like the whole damn thing was a setup. The Russians were just trying to bait the Georgians into coming in. It's like a mousetrap. And once the Georgians took the bait, snap, that was it. They were toast.
Yeah. And, you know, that is the big question. I know you talked about that a little bit on the site, Jim, but, you know, why did the Georgians get pulled into that?
Because they were sucker punched. I mean, that's the mind games they play down there. Basically, Georgia is Russia's Grenada. You know, 20 years ago in the 80s, after Vietnam, we needed a victory, and Ronald Reagan said, hey, we got some problem with commies in Grenada. Let's invade. So we went down there. It was, you know, hammers going after flies, or sledgehammers going after flies. But we won a victory. We overwhelmed them. There were a couple of Cuban construction workers there. We swept them aside. We took some casualties because we hadn't really fought a war in over a decade. And that was all hailed as a great victory. Same thing is happening in Russia with Georgia, which was, you know, not much larger an operation than what we did down in Grenada.
Well, Austin, what do you think is the proper response from the U.S. and Europe to this? How do we get it back to some sort of status quo?
Well, you're not going to come back to a status quo.
So you think Ossetia is just going to become
part of... You mean status quo ante? What obtained on, say, August the 1st of 2008?
Right, or are they going to move into, are the Russians going to demand that Ossetia become part of their territory, or is it going to...
They already have.
They've already basically said that they want to recognize it as independent, South Ossetia.
Okay.
They're playing what I talked about the Kosovo precedent right when this broke out. We talked a little bit about it on the radio and then the column I did some 15, 16 days ago on the Russell-Georgia War and talking about the Kosovo precedent. For 8 years, since 2000, I mean, go back and look at our archives on Strategy Page. A year after 1999, the Kosovo War, you can find traces of the Russians saying a unilateral declaration of independence by Kosovar Albanians, meaning Kosovo becoming a separate from Serbia, is a very, very bad precedent. And they even started using, I want to say 18 months ago, maybe it's 2 years ago, the term that was, as it was translated, a red line issue, meaning it was one of our most important issues. That, from Moscow's perspective, that Kosovo not become unilaterally independent. Now, that happened right at, the end of February 2008, this year. The international, they approved, for the most part, Western Europe, United States. There were a few exceptions, Romania and Spain and Greece weren't.
And Russia said at the time there will be repercussions.
Yes, that's right, they did. And one of the things they're saying is, see, that this is a legitimate, very legitimate point to make on the Russians' behalf. And we've made several here. Jim described them as boorish, but before we get swamped by Russian emails, take a listen to some of the other things Austin and Jim have said about you Russians, okay? The Russians were saying, the diplomats, the Kosovo precedent will affect at least 200 ethnic regions on the planet. I've said that may be an undercount, depending on how you look at what goes on in South Asia, Southeast Asia, Africa, and even including parts of South America. There may be 500 or 600, but let's just take the Russians' figure of a couple of hundred, and that's a legitimate point and an issue after the Cold War and in the 21st century. The issue here is, how are borders going to be adjusted? How are we going to deal in a world where we know about genocide and ethnic cleansing? We see it on TV. It's being covered, and it's unacceptable. But the local authority or the local or the sovereign nation is maybe they're prosecuting part of the ethnic cleansing, as is the case with Serbia. And how are you going to deal with this issue? And the Russians kept saying giving unilateral independence is a bad precedent. Well, they're showing you the Moscow, our Russian interpretation, and I don't take this because I say this that I agree with them. I don't happen to agree with them. But I always thought that it was absolute best-case thinking. In other words, borderline utopian to argue, as the EU was doing, European Union, was that Kosovo is a one-off deal. It's only going to happen once. We'll do it this way. Well, that's not the way things work on this planet. It tends to work more like Russia saying, well, it's on our border, it's in our interest, you guys did that, NATO invaded in 1999, well, we've, as Jim said, it may have been invading Georgia, but we're going to do it, we're going to show you how we interpret that precedent, at least on our periphery, where you do not have the conventional land power, you don't have the unconventional power, you have limited diplomatic power. Now, there may be economic issues. I don't think all the economic chips are in Russia's, under Russia's control about what the repercussions from the West could be, or repercussions from the East. The Chinese didn't like this either. And despite the Russians making noises about, we'll pal around with Iran and the like, or pal around with Syria, those aren't good pals to have, and the Russians know that. That said, you're not going to get back to where you were on August 1st. There's going to be some sort of a new relationship, new governmental structure in Abkhazia or South Ossetia. I believe that there are some Kosovar Serbs, ethnic Serbs living in Kosovo, who are praying that there might be some trade so that Mitrovica and the northern part of Kosovo, which is predominantly ethnic Serb, might become part of Serbia, and there might be some adjustments with South Ossetia and Abkhazia. But I'm giving you something that is pure speculation, Dan.
Right.
Nevertheless, Jim will ratify this. Russians have done things like this before. And not just Russians.
Right.
Other powers have when they made a deal like that. It's still not going to restore the status quo ante, and you have seen Poland's reaction, which is understandable, Polish reaction, the way Poles have been seeing Russian behavior for centuries, and that is that Poland wants security within NATO. Poland wanted Patriot Pact 3s. Now they're getting them in addition to ground-based interceptors. You see the West continuing to extend its own defensive shield. Ideally, in my view, Russia ought to be part of that Western defensive system. And maybe it will be decades from now. But as Jim has pointed out, they've still got wounded feelings. They're not the big player. They're part of a Western, a part of a European system, not the dominant player anymore. And their rate of change, who knows whether if they're actually going to make some of the political concessions or political adjustments to continue to Europeanize along the path of Europeanization that the French and British particularly would like to see Russia follow. Now, the situation is one where you have a number of diplomatic and political options, including continuing to support Georgia diplomatically and politically. I do not see a military response in Georgia over and above what's the humanitarian aid and the political and diplomatic support that Georgia's received. And Russia has gotten some of the things it wants. It doesn't mean it's going to get everything it wants, because it's got a situation, especially with most of Europe and even, let's say, the Chinese saying, we don't like the way you behave.
Thanks, Jim and Austin. Until next time.